I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. A really great book that's out now is Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. Its author, Peter Nowak, joins me now. He has written a fascinating book that looks at a trio of arguably the worst qualities of humankind, war, fast food, and pornography. These, our basest impulses, have, Mr. Nowak argues, brought us major technological advances. Peter Nowak is the senior science and technology reporter for CBC News Online. He is a longtime award-winning technology writer. The website for more is sexbombsburgers.com. That's one word, sexbombsburgers.com. The book is published by Viking. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto this day, Peter Nowak. Good morning, Mr. Nowak.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Not too bad.
You've recently just come back to Canada from promoting this book where?
Yeah, I was in Australia and New Zealand, and I'm still a bit jet-lagged, so if I seem nonsensical, that's the reason why. No, more nonsensical than usual, that is.
How was the book received there?
It was pretty well, actually, judging from the media and some of the bookstores I visited in Australia particularly. They seemed very enthusiastic about it. Some of the reporters I spoke to, the interviews I did there were really jazzed about it. So yeah, it's so far so good, I guess you could say.
And you spent time there previously?
Yeah, I used to live in New Zealand. Actually, I lived there for about a year and a half, 2005, 2006 or so. I worked at the New Zealand Herald there as their technology reporter, and so that was quite an experience, a lot of fun as well.
Now, how do they look at the theme of the book, that war, porn, and fast food have given us all these advances in technology? Because sort of looking at it, you would think that it's probably a more North American thing.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. It has, I mean, if you read the book, it is pretty much an American-centric story, and you know, I'm a Canadian, so I don't necessarily want to, give Americans more credit than they're due. But I think in this sense, in the realm of technology and research and development, definitely the last century has been very much an American story, especially when you're looking at these three areas, the military, pornography, and food. So interestingly, though, the rest of the world, other countries, I think, understand this point. And the thing is that these are, just because that's where the research dollars are in the U.S., it doesn't mean that this isn't an international story, and it very much is an international story. And I conclude the book by suggesting that, places, there's been a lot of talk about China and how China, the next century, is going to belong to China. Well, these are definitely three kind of instincts that are universal, like I said, and they're certainly found in China as well. And if there's no reason to believe that China isn't going to take the same sort of lead in producing, military technology, pornography technology, food technology over the next century as well.
And it's an interesting look at China because if we just take war, for example, they're ramping up their military, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they're going to war, as you say in the book, but because they're sort of playing catch-up. And porn isn't really as prevalent, I guess, because the government's trying to stamp it out. And fast food, I guess fast food is there now, isn't it?
Yeah. I spoke to a guy who, in doing this book, I spoke to one of the research scientists at India's military food lab. And one of the things he was telling me was that food processing is really taking off in India right now because people are, the economy is motoring forward, so people are getting higher and higher incomes. More people are sort of being lifted out of poverty. And the side effect of that, he said, was that as people are working more, as more and more people have jobs, they have less and less time to spend at home and farm and or cook. So, of course, they're going, for the food, for more processed foods, which is kind of a duplication of what you saw in the U.S. Following the Second World War. That's when mass food processing really took off. So same thing is going on in China, and it's no coincidence that China and India are some of the fastest growing, those are the fastest growing markets for fast food. McDonald's and KFC in particular are adding restaurants in those two countries hand over fist, again, duplicating what they did in North America in the 50s and the 60s.
Will we see duplication or I mean, we're seeing duplication, I should say. Will we see innovation in China?
Yeah, absolutely. In all three of these areas. Going back to the military for a second, China's the second biggest spender on military next to the United States. And there, you know, over the last, I think it's been the last 20 years, there's been a steady increase every year in how much China's spending. And as I said, you know, it's not necessarily that they're planning to go to war with anybody. It's just that China's recognized, they've looked at the U.S. example, and they've seen the benefits that come out of military spending, which are all of these side spin-offs. You know, the book is full of them, from things like plastic bags to hairspray to microwave ovens to whatever. You know, you spend the money on the research and development on weapons, and the byproducts are inevitably going to crop up and spin their way into the consumer world. So, yeah, there's absolutely going to be innovation, both from China's military spending, also in their food industry. I mean, you know, it's kind of been a science fiction premise for years that, you know, maybe we'll be eating food in pill form in the future. some of that could become a reality from what comes out of the Chinese market and the Indian market.
Now, I'm interested in robots just a sec here, because in reading the book, I was you wrote about the Roomba. Mm-hmm. And that's that thing that vacuums your floor, I guess, right?
Yep.
And I was on last night, I was on YouTube looking up videos on how it works and the sort. Now, you went to, I was reading something somewhere that you went to the, I guess it's, is it the porn convention in Las Vegas?
Yeah, every year there's the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which is the big technology convention where, you know, Sony and Panasonic and all those companies show off their latest stuff. But pretty much right next door to it is the Adult Entertainment Expo, which it used to actually be part of CES, but then, you know, the mainstream guys decided, hey, we don't want these porn guys here, because that's where all of our attendees are spending their time.
Yeah.
So they kind of spun off into their own thing.
And you saw, I guess, what are they called, sex robots? No.
Yeah, there was sort of one of the big attraction at this year's adult show was the unveiling of this supposed sex robot. Roxy is her name. That's Roxy with three X's, of course. So the fellow who designed this robot, I believe his name is Douglas Hines. He's I think he's a software engineer in New Jersey. So he, you know, he put out a press release that he was going to unveil this world's first sex robot at the expo. And so a lot of mainstream media showed up. I think the New York Times was there, and, you know, other mainstream reporters. And so he showed the thing off. It was pretty much a disappointment. It was kind of it was pretty much just a moving, or not even a moving, but more of a talking sex doll, which those have kind of been around for some years anyway. So I think he's still a ways off, or we're still a way off from an actual functional sex robot, but. What was interesting from it, I thought, was the amount of attention and the amount of mainstream attention and mainstream reporters that showed up for the announcement. Kind of shows that I think the general public is has a serious interest in something like this. I don't know whether it's for morbid curiosity or other reasons, but I think people are almost waiting for it. They're waiting for it to drop.
And I guess growing up, we all thought that by now we'd have, like, robots in sort of like the Jetson sense, like they, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the robot technology has come from the military, right?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of sources of it. I think when the average person thinks robots, they think Japan, and they think of, you know, these robots that we see periodically on TV, whether, you know, they're designed by Toyota or Honda, whether they play violins or they're able to play soccer or whatever, and there are these, you know, kind of humanoid-looking robots. But the problem with those robots is that each one of them is prohibitively expensive. They cost millions of dollars, and they don't really do anything practical. I mean, they can play soccer, but does that serve any, you know, practical need in society? Not really. So the robots that are actually, you know, being made cheaply and for useful purposes are almost the sole domain of the military right now. So whether it's bomb disposal robots or whether it's, you know, the flying UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles that can find terrorists and shoot at them, or, you know, exploration robots for going into caves and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, the vast majority of robots are being made for those purposes. But the good news is that the companies that are making those robots, they've got a much bigger market in mind. They're not thinking, hey, we want to sell robots to the military forever. We want to take what we're learning here and apply it to the consumer market. So the maker of the Roomba, the vacuum cleaner, it's a company called iRobot. They're one of the leaders in this sense, and they've got robots that can clean your eaves trough. They've got one that can clean your swimming pool. So they're a major military supplier, but they're quickly transforming the knowledge that they're gaining there into the consumer market, and that's where you're going to see. Probably some of the Jetsons robots come in. It's going to come from these companies that have learned from the military how to make robots cheaply and how to make them useful. They may not look humanoid like the robots in the Jetsons, but, they will be robots and they will be useful.
Now, food has changed a great deal in the last 70 years, and reading the book and seeing all the examples that you bring up, I mean, it's just fascinating to see how it's changed. Some would say that they've contributed to the ills of our society in terms of high sodium intake, high sugar, high fat, and the sort. Do we blame that simply on fast food? I guess a lot of these advances came from the military as well, right?
Yeah, well, the history of food processing is very much intertwined with the military as well. You have to consider that the military is the food industry's first customer. Full stop right there. In the book, I go as far back as Napoleon, who, he needed food to feed his armies as they were marching through Europe, and that was essentially the birth of food processing. The process of canning was developed for Napoleon. So that's held true ever since then. So the Second World War was another great example, where the U.S. had to bring its troops over the ocean to Europe and somehow feed them. Europe was obviously in no position to mass-produce the amount of food that all these soldiers needed. So all of these new technologies were created and developed during that war, things like dehydration and flash freezing and that sort of stuff. So it was developed to basically feed these armies on the move that are far from home. And the thing that I think a lot of people miss is that that food technology is very central to every other luxury that we have. If we can't supply ourselves with food, if a country can't supply itself with food, its people with food, then really the people of that country can't really concern themselves with anything else. If you were worried about where your next meal is coming from, you're not going to worry about whether you should get the next iPhone upgrade or whether you should get whether you should be thinking about getting a 3D plasma screen. It's sort of the real first basic. So when I talk about food or fast food in the book, I'm not just talking about McDonald's and KFC. I'm talking about food processors as well, who have basically sped up the process of food, whether it's farming it or processing it or transporting it or even consuming it. So essentially, food processing is the real basic upon which all of our other luxuries are based.
But some people would argue that what has happened to food hasn't been good, whether it's factory farms or fast food that we can get ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, in the book, look at sort of the morality of it?
Yeah, I do. I think I generally kind of stayed away from the morality of it. There's no doubt that, there's been a lot of books and movies recently, Food Inc. or Fast Food Nation, etc., that have kind of put a spotlight on some of the ills of the food industry, and I don't disagree with those. I'm very much against animal cruelty as well, and there are certainly a lot of things that can be improved there. The thing that I do, one of the sort of stances I do take in the book is I do come out pretty strongly in favor of genetically modified foods. That's a big controversy right now in many parts of the world, particularly in Europe and Africa. The reason there is, again, it goes back to the whole notion that food is the ultimate basic that needs to be secured before anything else really happens. And the fact is that a lack of food is a major, major cause of societal instability, and that usually results in things like war and terrorism. So I talked to a number of people who are kind of involved in studying war and crime and that sort of thing, And all of them kind of agreed. I talked to a guy named Peter Singer, who's he's written a number of books on war. One of the books he wrote was Children at War, which is, of course, about child soldiers. And so he was telling me stories about how he had talked to child soldiers in places like Congo and Rwanda, and almost without fail, all of them acknowledged that a lack of food was the reason that they signed up for whatever military or terrorist force that they had joined, because these people were offering them the food, right? So if we sort of look at the whole idea of organic foods and locally grown stuff, which is there's a big push on that on those sorts of things in Western countries right now, I think that's all fantastic, but I think it needs to be put in context, and the context is that those are kind of luxuries. If you go to the grocery store and you shop organic, you're going to pay a much higher bill than if you, buy the non-organic stuff. And if you can afford that, that's great. But I think to put down, some of the processed stuff, I think to attack that stuff is a little bit short-sighted. Same goes with to get back to the genetically modified stuff. The argument against GMOs so far has been is that they have primarily been used, or the crops that have been produced are primarily the big money crops, things like soybeans and corn. And they haven't really, the whole technology of genetically modified foods hasn't really been applied for humanitarian purposes, which is what some people would like them to be used for, to create drought-resistant crops or water-resistant crops crops that don't need as much water, that sort of thing. That's coming. I think in the next year, I believe the Philippines is going to be finally rolling out this rice that has been modified to contain more vitamin A naturally. So hopefully we're going to start seeing some more humanitarian applications of GMOs. And I think that it's kind of a necessity in a lot of places. When we talk about this rice, for example, some of the food scientists I spoke to, they took real exception with the whole regulatory hoops that this rice is called golden rice. It's basically been in existence for 10 years, but it's been in regulatory hell because people are so nervous about introducing genetically modified foods. But apparently, something like 1 to 2 million children a year die from vitamin A deficiency. So that the people I spoke to were quite upset about this, and they said, "Well, when you've got that many people dying from vitamin A deficiency, doesn't that make you just doesn't that make you want to try just about anything, and then kind of worry about the whether there are any side effects afterwards?" I think I kind of agree with that view.
Back to pornography for just a sec, because it's something that people like to talk about, I guess.
Yep.
You got to look at a lot of porn in the course of writing this book?
Research, of course.
Yes,
all research.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't say I watched an extraordinary amount of porn. I did talk to a lot of porn people, and whether it was actresses or producers, etc. But and I actually even had dinner with some porn stars in Las Vegas. So yeah, I had some research, I guess you could say.
Yeah, it's just amazing in reading the book to see how even if you're not a porn connoisseur, if that's the word, how it's affected us. I just about an hour ago, I made a donation online for someone playing a charity hockey thing, and so I did that with my credit card.
Mm-hmm.
And in that itself, I guess we can thank the porn industry for the ability to do that, right?
Yep, there's a fellow I talked to named Scott Kaufman. He heads up a major porn company called the Adult Entertainment Broadcast Network. And one of the things he said kind of stuck with me, which was he said, "We haven't just shown the way in technology; we've also shown the way in economics." And the examples are countless. A good recent example, actually, is Roger Ebert, the film critic.
Yeah.
He just recently started up something called Ebert Club, which is you can sign up for, I think it's $5 a year, and you get access to all of his reviews plus all sorts of special content. And so when he launched it, he blogged about what was the sort of the motivation and the story behind this club. And he told a story about how he met this porn star named Danny Ash a bunch of years ago. And she, of course, ran a website called Danny's Hard Drive. And in the 90s, it was probably one of the most profitable websites on the internet. And so anyways, he'd run into her, and she told him all about how to make money through micropayments and this sort of thing. And so when he launched his club, and this was just a few months ago, he basically gave full props to Danny Ash. So yeah, there's an example of not just adopting technology early, but also figuring out how to make money with it. It's funny because on a plane ride back to Canada from Australia, I watched this documentary called Hardcore Profits. I think it was a BBC documentary, and it looked at how many mainstream companies have made are making billions of dollars off porn too. So, and it kind of focused on things like hotel chains. You know, obviously they make a lot of money in showing porn in their rooms at night. And also cable companies and phone companies. You know, they make money from selling people internet connections, which a lot of people use porn for. But also the cable companies are making tons of money from movies on demand, right? So yeah, I guess to go back to your question, yes. They are usually early adopters of new technologies. The internet is a prime example. And they're also among the first to figure out how to make money with those new technologies.
What is it? What does it say, though, about how we got to where we are today? About how we got here, though? Like, I guess we use sort of these less than stellar aspects of our humanity to get to where we are.
Yeah, that's kind of the point of the book, is the link between these three industries is... the fact that they are industries is because we have such want or need of these in these three areas. So huge industries have evolved around them. The point of the book is to say, well, the negatives of them are apparent. They're obvious. You know, you look at, you watch TV or you open the newspaper and you see the negatives of these three things all the time. But we don't ever really think of the positives that have come out of these things. And these are, the book documents just tons of them, things that are around us every day. So I think the point I was trying to make is that it's kind of sad that we can't seem to overcome our base desires and instincts, but the fact is that they've really driven us to do some amazing and great things, and perhaps without them we might still be living in caves.
Hey, say, have you sent a copy of the book to Paris Hilton?
A couple of people have asked me that. I haven't, actually, and it's on my to-do list. I must get on that immediately.
Yeah, because you thank her in the acknowledgments, right?
Yeah.
Peter, this is such a great book, and congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
All right, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. The website for more is sexbombsburgers.com. That's one word, sexbombsburgers.com. The book is called Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technologies We Know It. It's published by Viking. The CBC's Peter Nowak on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Flanta.